He's in there laughing his ass off because he knows more about the law than you do.
I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
My law is thy legal.
I will make it legal.
Objection, Your Honor! Strangling a witness!
I'm going to allow it.
We disagree.
That's it? We disagree?
Well, I can't say we agree. That's how I lost my first 10 cases.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 480. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing, sir?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I am great. You know, those originalism episodes were so fun. I am the editing time police on this show. And on last episode, I was just like, Andrew, no chaperones, you know, no parents. Go wild, man.
Oh, yeah. You let me have access to the punch bowl, man.
And that meant just a long episode of originalism. That's what it means for us. But still, we've got a follow-up on that. And we've got an interesting case being cited by both the defense and the prosecution in the Chauvin trial. That's interesting. I want to get the breakdown on that. And then we've got a wild card, but I'm going to go ahead and right now I'm using host privileges, Andrew, and I'm saying we're getting to the wild card today, no matter what, because I guess I'll pose it in the form of a question that we all know the answer to. Can Jordan Peterson sue for being depicted as Red Skull? The Red Skull. I don't know comic books. But anyway, the bad skull, guy. Yeah. The Red in the latest, what the heck is the... Oh, Captain America? Is that
Captain
what it is?
America.
Oh, there yeah. we go. I remember because Hugo Weaving is the guy in the movie I think I saw 10 years ago. Right?
Indeed. Indeed he was.
Good times.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
What feedback, what questions, what follow-ups on the originalism stuff have we gotten so far?
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of really great engagement on those two episodes, which I am really, really happy about. I'm glad we were able to do it. I'm glad we were able to find, you know, the right venue. So, let's tackle some of these listener questions and points. Number one, yes, I have spoken both to Julia and
to... Oh, I didn't know that.
I have, yep.
Wow.
And to...
I guess I find out the news with the rest of you plebes.
William Bode liked a reply back, which I said, you know, I'd be happy to have a discussion with him. Not quite the same, but okay. they are both aware of our episodes. And, you know, to the extent that there is interest in interacting, I am more than happy to interact and, you know, sort of clarify these issues. So I'm excited about that. And we will let you know if there are developments as events warrant. The second, and I got a bunch of these, and I do get it, right? Of folks who were like, well, you know, maybe you're both right, right?
Well, if that's true, then I just maybe all the originalists can resign from the court, and it'll be fine because it's all the same, right? So the originalists should resign from the Supreme Court because we're both right. So we agree, we're both right. If the originalists resign and are replaced by people with the normal jurisprudence, then I think we'll all be happy because we're both right.
Well, and the argument was, and there is not just a kernel, there is large grain of truth to the fact that Professor Bode defined originalism in a way differently than I would define originalism. And so a number of people have asked, you know, well, isn't the way to reconcile these two arguments that, you know, you're just defining the terms differently? And I wanted to specifically address that because if you define it as broadly as Professor Bode defines it, then Ruth Bader Ginsburg was an originalist, right? Then I'm an originalist. Then literally there's nothing left, right? Like, all you're saying is, you know, everything that is not, you know,
judges changing the law because they feel like it, right, which nobody does.
You could find such that it would not be the empty set, but it would be damn near the empty set. And that doesn't give us a meaningful distinction. And it is not the argument that Professor Bode wants to make, right? Yeah. So I've tried very carefully, you know, not to ascribe motive or intent, right? If I were doing that, I would say there's a sleight of hand going on here, right? That there is an equivocation fallacy of defining originalism as expansively as possible and then using it, right, in for two-thirds or three-quarters of your interview in the way in which we all interpret it.
And not only that, it goes the other way too, because he knows, and we all know, there are judges who don't identify as originalists, namely all the good ones. and so if you are doing this little trick, you're also implying that they are doing something awful when they're really not. You know, like, it's one thing to be like, oh, it's just a definition thing. I defined originalism as this completely normal thing that every judge does. But then people are hearing that and they're saying, well, I know that a lot of judges aren't originalists, so they must be doing this bad thing.
Yep, I agree. It is why I have and look, I'm trying to lay as many of my cards on the table as possible. I do this before, you know, whenever we have, if we have a debate or a discussion, because it is sort of part of my training in the law that, like, you get the best interaction when the other side knows what your arguments are, right? So very clearly, like, the first question I would ask Professor Bode if he were to come on the show would be, you would agree that, say, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not an originalist, mm-hmm. right?
So show me where she changed the meaning of the
law. right, exactly. You know, and I suspect, right, because I would give him the out, right? I suspect he would say, like, yeah, I'm trying to summarize it in a shorthand way, and you're sort of parsing down as a lawyer, right? And we would kind of move from
there. Oh, is he not a lawyer?
No, he absolutely is. He's a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. So, but, you know, so am I, and I oversimplify things sometimes. Right, again, trying to give benefit of the doubt here. All right, next question that came up a bunch of times, it's a really, really good point, is what about Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan's statement that, quote, we're all textualists now? And that is a little bit of lawyerly inside baseball.
We've talked about that on here several times.
But it's a good, but it's worth reiterating. In December of 2015, Elena Kagan, certainly prior to her appointment to the Supreme Court, and I think it's borne out in cases like Trinity Lutheran, for example, where, you know, she's fractured from the furthest left position on the court, a more moderate Supreme Court justice, you know, not the ideology. If we're using that number line again, it's so hard to keep it straight because all of the court right now is in the 90s, you know, on the right wing, you know, okay, maybe John Roberts is a 91 now or what have you. But, you know, I mean, Kagan would be, I don't know, a 40. It's hard to pull the numbers. In any event, she was there to honor Antonin Scalia. Now, that's not a job I would have taken. Okay, we know this because that was, in fact, your and my very first show together when you called me up and was like,
in honor of Scalia, I've got some punishment that is not both cruel and unusual that I'm going to do to him in front of you all today, and he can't do anything about it.
Indeed, and I came on, and from there, you know, small acorns led to mighty oaks. But so she's at a speech. She's giving the keynote, the Scalia lecture at Harvard Law School to honor Antonin Scalia. And then she's describing his influence in the legal profession. And in the same way, like, you and I disagreed in that that first Scalia non-honoring, which I said, yeah, he was a brilliant guy. And you're like, no, I think he's just an idiot.
Well, I don't think he's an idiot. But
and that's not fair. That's not fair. Right. But you disagreed with my characterization of his intelligence. She paid him a compliment. And she correctly described that he was an incredibly he was still alive at that point. But she correctly described the biggest influence that Antonin Scalia had at that point over the Supreme Court. And let me unpack that a little bit. This has actually changed in my lifetime practicing as a lawyer. Back when I just got out of law school and I was clerking for the Maryland Court of Appeals, right, our state Supreme Court, it was customary for judges right and left, including in particular my judge, to ask for legislative history as part of the background of understanding a statute, right? Understanding what that law meant. And what legislative history meant was drive down to Annapolis, go into the microfiche room, and pull up transcripts of the actual arguments, the actual debates on the floor of the legislature over the bill. And from there, you would then say, look, the people who wrote this intended this bill to do X. Okay. And this method of legal analysis is often summarized under the word purpose, right? What's the purpose of the statute? The biggest contemporary defender of the purpose approach is UVA professor Richard Ray. And I'm going to link one of his law review articles in the show notes. It's called The New Holy Trinity. It's super fascinating. And the point is, pre-Scalia, it was possible to look at a statute, have that statute be crystal clear on its face, and nevertheless, as a judge, say, right, but I want to know what the people who wrote this thing intended for it to mean. Give you, I could go through the Holy Trinity case that they talked about, which was a statute that prohibited entering into a contract for a non-citizen to immigrate and work within the United States. Right. And that's what the law said. And then a church hired an immigrant to come from overseas and pastor at their church. And the Supreme Court said, right. But we all know this law was not meant to apply to ministers. It was supposed to bar, quote, cheap, unskilled labor.
Oh, end of quote.
Right. So it doesn't apply to that church's contract. Right. And you're, oh, my God, like, is really, really illustrative here. And again, remember, my judge was a very, very conservative judge. Looking to purpose or not looking to purpose is not a lefty or a righty tool, right? It's a way of analyzing the text of the law. And one of the things that Antonin Scalia has succeeded in doing is today, I think very, very few judges approaching zero would say, if a law is crystal clear on its face, then it could be made ambiguous or otherwise reinterpreted based on what the people who originally passed the law intended for it to do. And that was not the case 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And a really, really good example of that we've talked about on the show that maybe goes the other way is Title VII, which says no discrimination on account of sex. Some of the earliest landmark cases, particularly in California, were claims of discrimination by men under Title VII. And the earliest judges sort of split two ways. They said, right, we get it. It says no discrimination on account of sex. But this was meant to protect women. It was not meant to protect men. We're not going to entertain challenges by men under this statute, even though it clearly says no discrimination on account of sex. Today, that view is, like I said, an exceedingly small, approaching zero view of how to interpret a statute. And so when Justice Kagan said, we're all textualists now, that's what she meant. She meant, when the text is crystal clear, we do not look for reasons to depart from it that are grounded in other considerations. Now, when the text is not at all clear, right, then Justice Kagan continues to apply the same methodology I described in our two episodes. So that's the right context for that comment. And again, it sort of shows the difference between the kind of thing you would say at a lecture, you know, at a three cheers for Antonin Scalia lecture versus what you would put in your opinions, right? She would never have put that in a, in a, in an opinion because it's not true, right? It's a hyperbolic statement meant to describe somebody who was a singularly influential Supreme Court justice, you know, whether you like it or not. So that's the Kagan bit.
I was having trouble tracking who cared about what side of that argument, because on one hand, it's about intent, and you would think originalism is about what did they intend at the time. But that on the other hand, it sounds like you're saying he is made. I mean, the comment is like he made everybody textualists. I have to admit, I don't totally understand what went on there.
This is really crucial to sort of the next couple of comments. So I'm glad that you brought it up. Remember that for a textualist like Scalia, it is not what is subjectively going through the heads of X number of legislators who vote in favor of this. It is what was, for Scalia, the original public meaning of the words of the thing that they wrote, right?
Okay.
And so what that leaves open the possibility for, and Scalia himself has written about this, is I am a state legislator, or I'm a founding father, right? Well, you know, whatever. And I write a provision into, I vote for a provision that is written into law or the Constitution or whatever. And I intend subjectively for it to do a thing that it doesn't say.
Okay.
Too bad on me. Elect smarter legislators is what Scalia would say. What it means is what it means to, at the time, to the general public, to their understanding at the time that that law was passed. So it's not, it has nothing to do with the subjective intent of the people who voted in favor of it. Now, as you point out, you know, as we talked about at some length on our originalism episodes, what people intended is often very, very good evidence of what the words meant, right? Mm. So, you know, I think it shows the difficulty in making these kinds of hairline distinctions. But that's how, if I'm steel-botting Antonin Scalia, and that's as much as I can do on that, by the way, that's where he would draw that distinction. Next up, a number of folks, and I always forget that not everybody has been with us since the very beginning. So this is a good time to
wait a minute. There are people episodes who haven't listened to all 480 episodes, including all the lambs and the bonus materials and...
Yeah, I mean, there should be a law against that. I know. I mean, but a bunch of people said, well, isn't the strongest argument against contemporary originalism, you know, I went with Janice versus Ask Me, isn't D.C. v. Heller a much stronger example of that? 100%, yes, it is, right? Like,
we ought to do two episodes or more about that in 2016.
Yeah, we should.
Okay, we're going to hop in our time machine.
Episodes 21 and 26 of the show from 5 years ago now go through the history of that. The nut graph is prior to 2008, no federal court had ever overturned a federal law regarding the possession of firearms as violating the Second Amendment. And this was a challenge, a manufactured, astroturfed challenge to a decades-old ban on handguns in the District of Columbia, right? Something that people had been living under for generations. You just knew you were not allowed to have a handgun in D.C., and that became the landmark case that turned into D.C. versus Heller and invented the contemporary NRA-backed, quote, understanding of the Second Amendment out of whole cloth. They had to do it in D.C. because the Second Amendment had not yet been incorporated to the states as of 2000. So, you know, if you're sitting there thinking like this has been a key individual right that has been at the bulwark of it hasn't. Right. It literally, we did not know that it applied to state law until a case called McDonald versus Chicago in 2010. Right. Jeez. 11 years ago. So yes, those are very, very good arguments against originalism. It's just that we'd already covered them. And then finally, I included this. That I actually think that your question probably made this a little more clear. But Matt Welland wrote in and said, I'm a software engineer, and for most programming languages, counting starts at zero instead of one, which got me thinking, and you might anticipate where this is going. The one example we held up was the president must be over age 35, right? what if as a society, we collectively decide to start counting from some other number, right? Like we just, you know, count your birthday, you're 100 when you're born, right? And he says, look, this is obviously a stupid hypothetical, but, you know, for argument's sake, if someone was counted as 100 when they're born and we count upward, would an originalist in that situation be happy with a newborn child running for office? And here, again, I wanted to use this to make sure we're steelbotting the other side and sort of carefully define it is the original public understanding of the words at the time that they were enacted. Right. And so if the words later come to have different meanings, then that's an area where I think Professor Bode's, like, even his
change.
Not the same items is kind of fair, right? It's like, we get it. It meant 35 years old had a particular meaning in 1789, and now it doesn't because we're all counting in, you know, hexadecimal, right, or whatever. But we would still use...
Is that a place where your two theories would kind of converge and you'd both be like, yeah, 135 then?
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. Under modern, you know, and our reasons would be different, right? We would say effectively, I shouldn't even say our reasons would be different. I would say the way in which, right, you go back to, you know, we Gargnax the Zorblin, right? You would say, okay, Gargnax meant what we would call 2F7 today, and they called 35 back then. And then you would still apply it. So I don't think that that is a valid criticism. And again, it hinges on that sort of knife's edge of the difference between a lot of different things and original public understanding of the text. And I think that goes to illustrate the reason I went through some of these sort of, you know, edge cases and the like is I think the fact that the word text was not mentioned, as far as I can tell, in the original interview is one of sort of the overarching problems I have with it, right? Because it is so key to what the originalist argument is about, right? It is, you recall, we read those definitions from Scalia and from Bork that said, look, the only thing that you can call the law is the written text of the law. And that is where so much of the substantive disagreement takes place. No, we can call lots of other things the law. You might not agree with that, but, you know, that goes a long way towards explaining the differences in approaches far more so than what was described. So keep it coming. Obviously, love talking about this. I think you're going to get a lot more, you know, why originalism is bad and you should feel bad in the future. And we had a lot of
engagement. Along the lines of that last comment, there was a good, I was trying to make this argument at the time. I'm not sure I quite have it outlined yet, but in my mind, there's something to do with like the ongoing consent of the people being governed and how they're understanding the law. And then all of a sudden Scalia comes along and is like, nope, actually it was this way all along. Cause someone pointed out in the Facebook group, like, wouldn't we just, if we were going to pass an amendment, like if tomorrow we're, well, I guess this is already true with the Supreme Court, but if tomorrow it's like, sorry, everything means what they meant at the time, what the words meant at the time, then we would have to pass amendments. But then the constitutional amendments, a lot of them would just be the same exact wording because we all think it means something now, you know? And I was like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Like that, I think that sort of, I know that I have it entirely right, but that sort of illustrates the absurdity of this. Like we would have to pass an amendment that has the exact same wording because we all think that means something now. It doesn't matter what it meant back then so much.
I think there's a lot in that objection. And where I would begin is actually something we cut for time from part one, and that is basic social contract theory, right? And the idea is, among social contract theorists, right? Like we talked about, you know, is there a concept of rule of law? Do you have an underlying moral obligation to obey the laws out of something other than self-interest, right? And one of the justifications for that is the idea of social contract theory. And contract theorists are sort of all over the map on whether it's like, oh, all I have to do is show that, like, hypothetically 800 years ago, you know, your ancestors would have agreed to X, right?
Yeah. That's
a, you know, sort of more Hobbesian contract versus a more Rawlsian view of the social contract, which is like, no, this is an ongoing process, right?
I want to know if ongoing... you meant Hobbesian or if there's someone named like Hobbes or something.
Yeah, what's no, Hobbes? No, it's a, yeah.
Is it pronounced Hobbesian?
I have often heard it that way.
Oh, wow.
You can say Hobbesian as well. But,
okay. So. Just now my mind is blown. Look, I've been embarrassed by my past pronunciations. I think it's fair
so
play the
I.
other way.
Yeah. So have I. So, you know, break out the thesaurus. But
yeah,
I will
write us in on Hobbesian. I want to know.
I will defend Hobbesian. But but yeah, so if you believe that the social contract justification requires some ongoing back and forth, right? A reflective equilibrium between the citizenry and their representatives, as I think most modern political philosophers would, then that has the implications that you've described. It also has the implications of, right, like why we generally think a free society can't prevent you from leaving, right? Like, you know, because there's this notion of it's not just theoretical consent, it's actually some level of real ongoing consent. Right. Like, and at minimum, like, you got to be free to get out. If you can't leave, then, you know, how can we infer that you're here voluntarily? So I think that's an excellent, excellent point. And I would love to spend another hour talking about it. But, you know,
I was going to say, people wouldn't believe what we had to cut from Andrew's notes. He's like, okay, you got to start off. Where do I start? We're all actually energy. It's the energy between, it's the bonds. We're not actually, no, I can't go that far back. there was a lot
so
of
it all
deep
begins
diving.
13 billion years ago.
Down. The law. Down. The law. Okay, Andrew, why is Graham v. Connor being cited by both the defense and the prosecution in the Chauvin trial?
Because it is the first time that the Supreme Court clarified what it meant for a police officer to use excessive force. And you might be looking at the citation going, 490 U.S. 386. Yeah, this case is from 1989. So let that one sit in for a little bit. It is also not a criminal case. It's a civil lawsuit. It is a Section 1983, 42 U.S. 1983 claim. Because under that statute, when a state actor acting under color of law violates your civil rights, you can then sue them for damages, right? So we've all heard about 1983 claims. We've talked about this. I think we did a dedicated episode on the show. But you can get civil damages against state officials who violate your civil rights. So the question was, in this case, were the plaintiff's civil rights violated by the police? So then you have to make that determination. And the Supreme Court clarified the rules. And again, terrifyingly recently. So here are the facts of the case. On November 12th, 1984, Dethorn Graham was diabetic. He felt the onset of an insulin reaction and asked his friend, William Barry, to drive him to a nearby convenience store so he could purchase some orange juice to counteract the diabetic reaction. Barry drove him to the corner convenience store. Graham walks into the store and the line is 12 deep. And he's like, all right, screw that. I'm leaving. Asks his friend, just drive me to a friend's house that's right around the corner and I'll drink something sugary or eat something sugary at my friend's house. Now, a police officer named Connor watched Graham enter, kind of look around and then leave the store. And the officer decided that he was going to follow Graham, that there was something wrong about this. So I'm going to ask you a question that I could not answer from reading the text of this opinion. And I think you know what that question is going to be. It is, what race is Graham and what race is Connor?
I mean, obviously, black and white is what you're probably looking for. But oftentimes, you know, plenty of non-white cops also racist as well.
Yeah, black and white is what I was looking for. It is the correct answer. You would not be able to tell that from the opinion. The opinion is 100% silent.
So that's not relevant information to them.
Yeah.
Not at all. Okay.
Not relevant information.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. It's totally irrelevant to the case, I'm sure.
Let's go back to what was happening. Half mile from the store, Connor pulls over Barry. Remember, that's the friend. And Barry says, look, like Graham is suffering from a sugar reaction, right? The officer says, no, I watched you come in and case this joint. You're going to sit and wait here in the car until we find out from, you know, our comically oversized walkie-talkies what happened back at the convenience store. So then Connor goes back to his patrol car and calls for backup.
Oh, okay, that
is an undisputed fact. Graham, suffering the onset of his diabetic reaction, gets out of the car and runs around the car twice and then sits down on the curb and passes out. I have made a look at this. I sent a message to my dad who has some diabetic issues. I don't know if that's appropriate diabetic behavior or not. I'm sure our listeners can weigh in. But that's what Graham does. Then backup shows up. And one of the officers comes over, picks up Graham, cuffs him tightly, and all the while, like, the friend is going, look, just get him some sugar. He's diabetic. He's going to pass out. He's having a reaction. The officer says, quote, I've seen a lot of people with sugar diabetes that never acted like this. Ain't nothing wrong with the MF-er, but he's drunk. Lock the SOB up. Some of those words have been clown-horned at the Supreme Court.
Oh, they got a Supreme Court clown horn. That's interesting. Yeah. I wonder whose job that is. It's actual clown.
Brian actually moonlights the Supreme Court in the 1980s. Several officers then lifted Graham up from behind, carried him over to the car, and, don't love this verb, placed him face down on the hood. Graham now is in and out of consciousness, and he says, look, if you get out my wallet, I have a decal on my license that shows that I'm a diabetic. In response, and he, you know, tries to squirm to get, you know, get his wallet. In response, he's handcuffed and face down on the car at this point, right? One of the officers told him to shut up and shoved his face down against the hood of the car. Four officers then picked up Graham and threw him headfirst into the police car. A friend of Graham, right, has now caused a community, you know, response. So a friend, maybe the same friend that his house he was going to, has brought orange juice over, brings it over to the car and says, look, just let me give him some orange juice. He's cuffed. He's in the backseat of the car. Officers refuse to let him have it. Finally, Officer Connor receives a report from the convenience store, right now coming back over the telegraph wires, because it's 1989, that Graham didn't do anything wrong. There's nothing, you know, there was no holdup. There's nothing missing. There's nothing wrong. You just like tracked down a black guy who was having a diabetic attack, and the officers drove him home and released him. Graham, in this entire arrest, suffered a broken foot, cuts on his wrist, bruised forehead, injured shoulder, and developed tinnitus, a loud ringing in his right ear that continued to this day as of 1989. So 5 years into the future, probably for the rest of his life. So the question was, did the use of force by a police officer in that case constitute excessive force in violation of your constitutional rights?
Hmm.
And if so, which ones?
Boy, tough case. Yes.
The answer is, we don't know from, I do know the ultimate answer to this, but we don't know from this Supreme Court opinion. What this Supreme Court opinion did was clarified the rules, because the test that had been used at the Fourth Circuit was a subjective test, okay? What the Fourth Circuit said was, you, Graham, have to prove that the police used force, quote, maliciously and sadistically for the very purpose of causing harm, end of quote.
Wow.
That's not a great standard. So the Fourth Circuit said, and you know, you can't prove that, right? Like they weren't malicious and sadistic. They were, I don't know, cruel but usual, right? Like, whatever, right? That's what the Fourth Circuit said. And the Supreme Court overturned that finding. They said, look, the right that's being violated here is your Fourth Amendment right to be free against unreasonable searches and seizures, which, by the way, they're correct on that, right? Like, that's how you analyze when the police are exercising dominion over a criminal suspect. It's a Fourth Amendment question. And they said, look, the word unreasonable does not have a subjective component to it. Here's how the Supreme Court put it. They said, as in other Fourth Amendment contexts, the reasonableness inquiry in an excessive force case is an objective one. The question is whether the officer's actions are objectively reasonable in light of the facts surrounding them, without regard to their underlying intent or motivation. An officer's evil intentions will not make a Fourth Amendment violation out of an objectively reasonable use of force, nor will an officer's good intentions make an objectively unreasonable use of force constitutional.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and by the way, even before I show how that's applied, I think you now see exactly why this case is being cited by both sides, because from the prosecution side of it, you're saying, look, we're not trying, nor do we have to prove that Derek Chauvin hated George Floyd, that he was trying. All we have to prove is that this was not an objectively reasonable way of restraining someone that was in police custody and control.
Are you saying there's, like, this is unclear whether or not that's the standard? Like, we don't know?
Oh, no,
no. Sounds like that ought to be the standard.
It is the standard. It remains the standard to this day. I'm going to tell you the Negatron side, but first I've got, you know, let me get through all of it. So how do you figure out whether this restraint is objectively reasonable? And again, I just want to point out, I love doing this after we've did a little bit more on originalism, because this is the kind of mainstream decision that we got up until 20, 25 years ago, even though this opinion is written by William Rehnquist, who flirts with some originalism, right? Very, very conservative guy. But basically the answer is you balance a bunch of factors, right? Because it would have done no good to say, like, well, what would the framers have thought about this? Because you didn't have, like, cops in 1791 the way you did today. You didn't have Terry stops, right? Like, that is the stop and frisk, right? Like, it would have been such a laughably stupid inquiry to say, right? You know, instead, what you say is, okay, the Fourth Amendment protects you against unreasonable searches and seizures. How do we balance those interests? And here's what the court said. The test of reasonableness is not capable of precise definition or mechanical application. It's a slap through the future at Scalia. Well, he's on the court at the time, so it's a slap across the aisle at Scalia. Its proper application requires careful attention to the facts and circumstances of each particular case, including, and I'm going to number these here for convenience, 1, the severity of the crime at issue, 2, whether the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of officers or others, 3, whether he is actively resisting arrest, or 4, attempting to evade arrest by flight. And that's not an exhaustive list, but that list is still used today. It's still in police training manuals in terms of how you figure out what level of force is appropriate to the situation. So put all that together, and you were sitting there thinking, like, well, this sounds like a pretty good case. It sounds like it got rid of a terrible standard, right? A high bar, and replaced it with an objective standard. And that's true. Graham's lawyer, for example, to this day, right, says that this is the most important civil rights case of the latter half of the 20th century. However, the question of how you balance those factors was described by the Supreme Court this way. The framing mechanism, right? How you determine is whether the force was appropriate under the totality of those circumstances, right? Using the factors that we just described, at the moment force was used, without 20/20 hindsight, and these are the words, from the perspective of a reasonable police officer.
Yeah.
And so now you see where we are. And in particular, why over the past 30 years, all of these cases, you will hear the police officer describing,
This is why I was afraid for my life.
This is why I exactly right.
But that's going to be tough in this case. I had my sunglasses on my head, didn't even move, weren't even, you know, like they're just sitting. I feel like a new court test could be if your sunglasses stayed on your head the whole time you were doing the murder, then you weren't really in that much danger.
You joke, but a 1990 Supreme Court, right, could very well have articulated that as one of the factors of the totality of the circumstances, right? Like how much, and you know, they wouldn't have said like, you know, do you have your sunglasses on? You know, they would have said, how much did you have to deviate from, you know, your normal practice, right? And when the answer is zero, like that should be a really strong argument against
it. He couldn't have looked more casual as he was doing the murder. Correct. Really couldn't have. He may as well have been plate spinning while he's doing it. Like, come on.
I think that's right. And so at the end of the day, I think that this legal standard will favor the prosecution. But this is why both sides are citing to the case, right? And so the prosecution is citing to it saying like, yeah, we got to look at the totality of these factors, and the totality of these factors amounts to zero risk to you, or as damn near zero as you can possibly get.
I want an extensive line of questioning about those sunglasses. Well, I guess he won't. Will he ever be on the stand? Probably not, huh?
But I'd be like, sure, do you still have those? Him on the stand. Yeah.
How are they looking? Are they scratched at all? They good? They still perfect? Those sunglasses that were on your head the whole time? You were never in danger in any way? Yeah. Those look beautiful. They're not a scratch on them. They enter into evidence. Those sunglasses, they're pristine. They're better than mine.
I chuckled there, but I absolutely think that that's a valid argument, and it is a valid technique. And I would like to see the prosecution do that. What they need to do, what this goes back to, you know, we talked about this in my kind of sad episode of revisiting Alan Dershowitz and the concept of testifying, which was literally the only thing Alan Dershowitz spoke on until the moment the check cleared for being on the O.J. Simpson defense team. I really very stupidly believe that Alan Dershowitz cared about this back then. But he would talk about how he coined the phrase testifying, right? It was because of these manuals, police officers are trained to give answers that respond to the factors that have been outlined in the law that exonerate their conduct. And we saw even a little bit of that in the Laudawful movies of Your Honor, right? Like where, you know, the classic of like the police officer at the very beginning. I mean, the entire thing goes off the rails in about 8 seconds. But the police officer is testifying like, I absolutely saw the defendant hide drugs on their person. And I could smell pot. And, you know, and these are just the kinds of things. Again, it's why I love the Dershowitz characterization as testifying that like, nobody really thinks that's the case, right? Like nobody thinks that police officers are trained bloodhounds, and you know they're like, I could definitely smell that, you know, sealed Ziploc bag of weed. Like no, you couldn't, right?
Yeah.
So the sad conclusion to the story, as you probably guessed, was that this was remanded back down to the trial court. The trial court once more said that Graham was the victim of unreasonable force. That was appealed to the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit reversed and said that the use of force in this case under the factors articulated by the Supreme Court was reasonable. So Graham never got a dime from the city.
What?
And, you know, today his family is active in lobbying with respect to police brutality causes.
Oh, my God. So, that is insane.
Yeah.
Nothing for all nothing. That.
Nothing.
Wow.
So that's the sad ending to that story. But that is the significance of the seminal case in this area, Graham versus Connor, and why you hear it being cited on both sides.
I actually have a little bit of faith in this case going the right way, but we'll see. Actually, no, we talked about in the Q&A. I want to ask you real quick. We have a minute. I said this on the Q&A last night, the Patreon Q&A, Tuesday. I feel a little bit optimistic about this case, and I grant that, you know, it's because we've heard from the prosecution so far. But it just feels like the evidence is overwhelming that even people who are kind of Blue Lives Matter-y in the jury might be able to see that, like, okay, this was just not reasonable behavior. How are you feeling about this case? Are you willing to predict anything?
I share that view with you. I think the prosecution has, and there are things that I have nitpicked at, but, you know, look, like, if one of these prosecutors watched one of my trials, right, they would nitpick. You're never able to.
Listen to our show.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're never able to articulate everything that's going on in your head. The prosecution has done an excellent job. And like I said on the Q&A, generally speaking, even though, right, at this point in the trial, your defense theory should be somewhat visible in your cross-examination of the witnesses. And that's just not the case, right? Like, it is very, very difficult, you know, to see them building a comprehensive case of George Floyd was a dangerous pill popper, but also, like, fragile and ready to die of an underlying heart condition at the next month. Like, it just, the argument wasn't great from the start, and I don't see that that it's being built up that way during the trial. So I share your cautious optimism, and we'll see.
We will see. Well, we have just enough time for a fun wild card that I'm insisting we cover. Does Jordan Peterson have a case?
Okay. This is my favorite story of the week. This is the best. Okay. So I know you're not a huge comic book fan.
I'm a zero comic book fan. I've seen some of the movies. I have never read a comic book. I don't even know what they are. Yeah.
All right. So the Red Skull is a Captain America villain, right? He is the Joker to Captain America's Batman. Like, that's how important he is. And he is a literal Nazi. And when I say a literal Nazi, I mean he got his nickname, the Red Skull, from Hitler, right? It was,
we got words for people like you back home. We're already comfortable being called Nazis. I don't know what you think.
Yeah,
some
exactly.
Rick and Morty humor there.
Right. I've actually seen that clip.
It's so good.
All right. Adolf Hitler gave him the nickname that he wears proudly. He wears the swastika on his chest. Okay, so also, we both know Ta-Nehisi Coates, right?
Sure.
He wrote the seminal article, The Case for Reparations. He is also a longstanding writer for Marvel Comics, right? So he wrote on Black Panther, consulted on the movie, which I think you've seen, which is excellent.
Yeah, right? I like the movie.
Black Panther's really, really good.
Michael B. Jordan was right, but yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what makes
the villain wrong. Yeah.
That's what makes Black Panther so good. So Ta-Nehisi Coates has also been writing for Captain America since 2018. And on the just released Captain America Volume 9, issue number 28, March 31st is released, the Red Skull goes on his YouTube channel to preach his 10 rules for life, as well as chaos and order, and the feminist trap, and the speech. I love this more than anything. The speech. So you have these two bits that are just amazing. When they show Red Skull monologuing, his speech about, like, you know, you, the American male, have been, you know, ground underfoot, and, like, women have been charged to do your jobs, but I offer you the sword of manhood. Okay. That's how that speech ends. And then watching that is Captain America. He's talking to a police officer, and he says, look, it's the same for all of them. They're young men. They're weak. They're looking for purpose. I found the flag. You found the badge. They found the skull. He tells them what they've always longed to hear, that they're secretly great, that the whole world is against them, that if they're truly men, they'll fight back. And bingo, that's their purpose. That's what they live for, and that's what they'll die for. And so Jordan Peterson has just found this out. And I need to say this, even though it pains me, Jordan Peterson has had a good sense of humor about this. I really, really, really wanted him to go James Lindsay, you know, just freak out and Jordan Peterson has been funny about it, right? Like, he's tweeted out like the Hydra logo with a lobster on, like it's pretty good. Like that kills me. But his fanboys do not disappoint, right? Like, his, if you go read over on the Jordan Peterson's tweets, every third one is, well, I can't wait until Dr. Peterson, you know, sues Marvel into non-existence. Yeah. By the way, like, way to prove you're not easily triggered snowflakes.
Mm-hmm.
So the case closed here. This is not defamation. This is not a copyright violation. Parodying a public figure's works is within the core of what you assholes who claim to be pro-free speech should find to be free speech. And I want to paraphrase apocryphal.
Andrew getting a little hot under the collar. I like it. I come after his comic books, and that's what'll do it.
So there was a line credited to philosopher Jeremy Waldron about Robert Nozick, because late in his life, Nozick, somebody who I've met, I've attended lectures from, you know, brilliant philosopher, wrote Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and then like sort of spent the rest of his life like kind of living down the fact that he was the Anarchy, State, and Utopia guy, and like actually wrote that. Like, wrote a long essay in a book called Socratic Puzzles that says, Anarchy, State, and Utopia was an accident. Like, I never really meant to be associated with these fringe libertarian nut jobs that, like, this is kind of bothering me, right? And Michael Waldron is said, I can't find this anywhere, I've looked for it, to have quipped like, well, if Professor Nozick is concerned that his views place him in rather nasty company, he should reflect that they are, upon close examination, rather nasty views. And I like to shorten that down to, Professor Peterson, perhaps you shouldn't have ideas that appeal to Nazis. So
if the skull fits,
oh my God, that is beautiful. If the skull fits, I love it. So there you go. Case closed. Jordan B. Peterson is Adolf Hitler's best friend, and there's nothing you can do about it, JBP fans.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE, failure time. Here we go. Another boulder. I'm not even Sisyphus. I'm Sisyphus if the boulder rolled down, just flattened me every time. And then I got to get up and just get flattened by another boulder. Is that Sisyphus? There's no pushing involved. Okay, here we go.
I honestly thought you might like break into Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba there. But anyway, here we go. Thomas. A 50-year-old nurse who had been fired from his job at the hospital told his attorney, I was fired because of my age, and I want to sue the hospital. Based on this information, the attorney filed an age discrimination complaint against the hospital in federal court. As it turned out, the hospital had hired a 52-year-old man as the nurse's replacement, the fact that rendered an age discrimination claim unavailable. The hospital responded to the complaint by filing a motion for sanctions against the nurse's attorney.
Wow.
Is the court likely to grant the hospital's motion?
Oh my gosh.
A, no, because sanctions are not proper against the attorney of a represented party. B, no, because the hospital failed to give the attorney the chance to withdraw the complaint in advance of filing the motion with the court. C, yes, because the nurse's attorney failed to conduct a reasonable pre-filing inquiry. Or D, yes, because the nurse's complaint contained legal contentions that were not warranted by existing law based on the facts of this case.
Wow. I think based on the fact that Sidney Powell still exists, I'm kind of leading toward a no answer, but maybe I shouldn't let that bias my answer. I don't know that we've ever had a question about this kind of thing, about like sanctions against the lawyer, have we in our 220? I don't remember one.
We have not. This is a new first. One.
Okay. So I'm going to just do what I think is reasonable. Sanctions. That's not the same as being disbarred, you know? So I know it's not just for messing with client funds. Okay. So the nurse essentially tells the attorney, I was fired because of my age and I want to sue the hospital. Now let's see what the attorney actually did. Filed an age discrimination complaint against the hospital in federal court. Okay. As it turned out, the hospital had hired a 52-year-old man as the nurse's replacement, a fact that rendered an age discrimination claim unavailable. So the lawyer has now filed something that is not available. Yeah, that seems pretty bad, but it doesn't seem like, you know, I don't know. This sounds like a little bit of negligence, a little bit of light lawyer negligence, but sanctions feel a little rough. Like that feels a little bit, you know, harsh, but who knows? Hospital responded to the complaint by filing a motion for sanctions against the nurse's attorney. So they go to sanctions right away. Okay. A, no, because sanctions are not proper against the attorney of a represented party. That sounds like nonsense to me. If the exam is porked, it'll be that. But sanctions are not proper against the attorney of a represented party. That doesn't make any sense. I'm pretty sure that is what they are proper for. I don't know. That doesn't make sense to me. B, no, because the hospital failed to give the attorney the chance to withdraw the complaint in advance of filing the motion with the court. That seems reasonable to me. Like B seems pretty solidly reasonable. I think that from what you've described in your interactions with the judge and the court and the other side, like I feel like there's a, hey, why don't you go ahead and withdraw this, you know, before you get sanctions slapped on you. Like you made an oversight. You should have investigated a little bit and you didn't. I don't know. B is what I'm leaning strongly towards. C, yes, because the nurse's attorney failed to conduct a reasonable pre-filing inquiry. I mean, yeah, maybe. Yeah, that sounds pretty, you know, like sounds reasonable. It could be that. D, yes, because the nurse's complaint contained legal contentions that were not warranted by existing law based on the facts in this case. I think that's too broad. I think that like D would mean there'd be a whole lot of sanctions flying around, you know, like that feels like a pretty broad legal contentions that were not warranted by existing law. Nah, no way. That's too broad. I think I'm between B and C. This is how this all turns out. You know, I pretty much, except for that one, I totally blew. It's usually between two and then I pick the wrong one. No, because the hospital failed to give the attorney the chance to withdraw the complaint in advance of filing the motion with the court. Or is it just, sorry, you should have conducted this reasonable pre-filing inquiry. So how lenient are courts? I don't know. I feel like you give them the chance. I'm going to go with B. I could see it being C. I'm between B and C. I could see an argument for C. Like, you got to do this thing. You didn't do this thing. Sanctions. I also could see, you know, you give them the chance to say whoopsie, you know, whoopsie daisy. I feel like a takesies backsies whoopsie daisy and something like this is reasonable before you get sanctioned. So I'm going to go with B. That's my answer. Could be C, but I'm going with B.
All right. And if you want to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that by now. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Hope you're enjoying all the stuff. We got a lot off of movies coming in another, let's see, a week or so. You know, we usually try to get it right around the 15th. So can't wait for that. I mean, if it's even half as good as Cop Rock, then
if even half of this is true.
Yeah. So let's thank our new patrons. And it's my turn to go first. So thank you to Debbie Doxy, Katie Evans, Felix Napichnig, Segarath, Shannon Haleman, Elfie, Chase Jones, I Don't Have a Scoop Name. Oh, is that a crossover patron? Zach and Aaron Lieb, your turn.
All right. And thank you for this list, Thomas. I will never forget it. Thank you, too. Epistemic humility sounds like you know you're right, but you're being humble. Would you consider epistemic modesty? Former talking pirate bird. And I guess that's it, folks. No more thank yous. We're disbanding the podcast. Thanks for your time. That is actually another thank you. So they contradicted yourself, but great name. Thanks to Carol Nadeau, Christopher Ibanez. Will you take an undergrad intern? Can't really do that, but thank you. Thanks to no Zorbling at this Garknax has ever porked the Gleeble exam. That's amazing. Nice. Thanks to Lester Power. To TBD, you do it. And thanks to, and I really have to read this, Ik Wu Dat, Ik Twi Hanjus, Was Don Khan, Ik Salmon Spellen.
No idea.
None. I could have just said like literally the most offensive thing on earth in
You could have said like, Dutch. Oh, no Zorbling at this Gargnax has ever Pork the Gleagle example. That was a fantastic one. I'm still loving that.
That was really good. Anyway, thanks to all of you. If you would like to make me say ridiculous things, head on over to patreon.com/law. Give us literally one American dollar. There was no better use for your entertainment than
Patreon even has the other currencies now. Could give us an Australian dollar, although I think it's a little bit less. So you have to give us like an Australian dollar 50 or something. But yeah, FYI, it's not just American currency.
Yeah, you could give us Greek drachme. You could, who knows, right? Yeah.
I can also name other currency. I can't. Euros. Yeah.
Euros. There we are. Yeah. We will take euros. I don't think the Greeks use the drachme anymore. I think they only use the euro, but I don't know. But if you have currency and it is legal tender, we will accept it.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Oh, that was a lot of fun. We got deep dives. We got heady stuff. We got important issues with the Chauvin trial, and we got a Jordan Peterson Red Skull. But that had everything, Andrew. That episode, I think we did it. We squeezed everything that's critical key OA into one show. That was a lot of fun.
I had a lot of fun too, and hopefully the listeners did as well.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.